This is part 23 of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson from 1948. The High Cost of Hospital Care. Needless hospitalization costs the public heavily. The physicians and surgeons who are given monopolies of facilities by closed hospitals are expected to boost its business and keep its beds filled. Since it is a convenience to busy practitioners to have their patients concentrated in hospitals, instead of having to visit them in their scattered homes, they are not at all loath to impose this item of unnecessary cost on their patients while boosting the patronage of their hospitals. In the great majority of voluntary hospitals, interns and nurses in training receive little or no pay. Pay and working and living conditions of the other workers are so unbelievably poor that even their unionization has not succeeded in New York in bringing the average wage level up to $15 per week. The hospitals, which continually appeal to the charity of the community and play on its gullibility, show little or no charity in these dealings. The social service workers and superintendents, alone among the workers in the hospitals, are amply or munificently paid. Barred by law from showing a profit, these hospitals generally manage to show a deficit on their books. They are built and exist on the charity and philanthropy of the community, continually begging funds. Though they often extend little or no charity to the public, they are exempted from taxation and are subsidized by the taxpayers as quote-unquote charitable institutions. Private hospitals, often superior, and show profits. The exorbitance of the closed hospital charges becomes more apparent from a comparison with those of the commercial, proprietary, or private hospitals. These hospitals are privately financed and built and are operated for the frank purpose of netting their owners a profit. The contrast is sharp. The modern private hospital is a high-class hotel for the sick. It receives no endowments or contributions from the public. It is erected on valuable ground which is purchased for the purpose. The construction is generally luxurious, fireproof, and ultra-modern. It is expensively and comfortably furnished, and its appointments are the best. The equipment is complete, and the last word in modernity. No expense is spared to ensure the safety, comfort, and well-being of the patients. They generally pay their help better wages than do the voluntary hospitals and higher help of higher caliber. Unlike the voluntary closed hospitals, they pay taxes. Nevertheless, private hospitals generally charge the patient less for the same caliber of service and accommodation. And when properly managed, they generally show excellent profits. The public has discovered that the cost of the superior accommodations of the private hospitals is less than in the supposedly charitable, voluntary hospitals, and the treatment better. The patient in the private hospital is not called on to surrender his rights as a man and as a citizen. He is allowed to freely choose the physician to whom he will entrust his care. The patient is not denied the trusted, competent, and reasonably priced services of a physician of his choice, as is the case in the voluntary hospital, merely because that physician is not a member of the monopolizing clique. In many communities, the voluntary closed hospitals have been able to hold their own against the competition of the private hospital only with the aid of the corrupt powers of the ACS, AMA, and social service allies. It is not surprising that the private hospitals show good profits when properly managed and times are propitious. They are merely hotels for the ill. Though the menage of good hotels is even more luxurious and expensive than that of a hospital, they generally manage to show good profits when well patronized. Not even the plea of expense of special hospital equipment can be interposed as an item that imposes higher cost on the hospital. For many modern hotels have completely equipped hospitals on their premises for the use of their guests and for the health. It had become the custom of many physicians in cities such as New York to refer to their operative patients to hotels for superior hospital service at lesser costs. But the hospital lobby stopped this devastating competition by prevailing on the licensing authorities to deny licenses to hospitals maintained in hotel premises. Deficits of voluntary hospitals not due to charity. The surprising feature of the situation is that the voluntary hospitals can manage to show such large deficits in spite of their exorbitant charges. When questioned on the matter, hospital authorities point to their quote-unquote charity work as a justification for the losses, but the voluntary hospitals generally extend little charity to the community which it does not pay for. The ward cases either pay an average of $3.50 a day for their hospitalization, or the community pays it for them. When no payment is available, the voluntary hospitals transfer the cases to public hospitals, often at grave risk to health and life. The relatively small amount of occasional charity extended by institutions is outbalanced by the charitable contributions obtained from the community by appeals and drives. Charges made by the voluntary hospitals for services in their wards should not involve any loss to the institutions if they were efficiently and honestly managed. This is made apparent by a comparison with the charges made in the second rate and the workmen's hotels. In hotels of the latter class, a modestly furnished room and 3 meals a day, which are adequate for a healthy man, may be had at $1.50 to $2 a day. For a bed to sleep in, 3 simple, meager meals a day, medicine costing a few cents, and the moiety of service, which costs them little or nothing, the hospitals of New York and other cities charge the ward patient from $4 to $6 a day, and they cry that charity is exhausting their funds. Hospital service plans, not adequate solution. Hospital funds, which offer group hospital care for fixed annual charges in many cities, have partly solved for some of the public one aspect of the problem of hospitalization cost. But none of these plans provides for the largest item in the cost of illness, private nursing care. Partial breakdown of the hospital plan in New York City, which has resulted in cancellation of many contracts in 1939 and modification of others, indicates that more fundamental remedies are necessary. The situation is further aggravated by the custom of hospitals of imposing excessive charges for extras on the hospital service cases. The hospital funds also exclude from participation persons over the age of 65 years, leaving the hospital problem completely unsolved for this growing group. Hospital fund plans, however, do aggravate the problem of the cost of medical and surgical care, for they have enabled the tottering closed hospital system to survive and have saddled on the public the high costs of medical and surgical care which its monopolies foster. This will become even more intensified if the American College of Surgeons, the AMA, and their social service allies, who are powerful influences in these plans, succeed in their efforts to restrict the benefits solely to approved hospitals. The solution of the problem of hospital costs rests primarily in the elimination of dishonesty, corruption, and rackets. Clinic toll of health and life. As a result of concentration of the ill and the crowding together of the non-infectious and undiagnosed infectious and contagious ailments, the clinic often serves as a focus of spread of infectious and contagious disease. A child taken to a clinic with a minor ailment may readily return home with the beginnings of scarlet fever or measles. Even thoughtful laymen can appreciate this potential menace to public health. The grand jury of the Bronx on the 28th day of November, 1937, handed up to Supreme Court Justice Tierney a presentment charging that the clinics of the Bronx were a focus of spread of contagious diseases. Tragic delay in diagnosis and treatment of ailments often results from clinic organization. An instance is cited in records published by the New York City Health Department in 1928. In a survey of deaths due to diphtheria that were observed in the contagious disease hospitals of the city, the case reads as follows. Diagnosis was not made on a child suffering from very early stages of diphtheria in the clinic of a hospital. When the child was returned on the following clinic day, 2 days later, advanced toxic diphtheria was obvious. The child died shortly after admission to the hospital. A physician in his private practice would have continuously and repeatedly observed the child. Clinic organization made this impossible and was responsible for the death. The barrier offered to follow-up of patients by clinic organization, the resultant irresponsibility of care, and its menace to health and life are freely acknowledged by even the staunchest advocates of the clinic system. The United Hospital Fund of New York stated in its 1927 report, that the care given the public in clinics is not thorough. This is a mild statement of the situation, as will be discerned in the following case. A.G., a man of about 24 years of age, occupation, bricklayer, earnings, $10 per day plus overtime, admitted to clinic with infection of a finger. After the finger was dressed, the surgeon hesitantly told him to return on the following clinic day. The surgeon hesitated because he faced a dilemma. He realized that though the infection was slight, there was a possibility that it might spread rapidly. Though under the rules of hospital admission, there was no justification for immediate admission. The hand should be watched twice a day. The surgeon would have been glad to refer the patient to his office for observation without charge, but by the rules of the clinic he was barred from so doing. When the patient returned to the clinic on the second day following, he presented an angry infection of the hand and forearm, which necessitated immediate amputation of the hand. This amputation might have been avoided if the victim had had adequate attention during the first 2 days of illness. This case is one of many which may be found daily in the clinics of any large city. It constitutes criminal neglect and gross malpractice, but under the law of most states, both doctor and clinic are immune from prosecution. The tragedy to the individual and his family is an outcome of neglect forced by the very nature of the clinic and of its rules and regulations. Such cases impress forcibly the fact that the most valuable item which the patient may require and secure from his physician is his personal care and the solicitude which accompanies the sense of individual responsibility. This is barred by clinic and institutionalized practice of medicine. Nothing is more false than the idea that clinics offer a physician experience superior to that of private practice. The reverse is the truth. Clinics generally breed in their physicians habits of haste, inaccuracy, and negligence. For the clinic doctor is a cog in the machine of medical mass production. He's not paid for his services, is denied any voice in the management of the clinic, and must submit to the indignity of punching a time clock. His clinic hours are determined by those of the paid porter. The clinic doctor, like the hospital attending, is the counterpart of the laborer on an assembly line. He is required to specialize and treat only a single organ or disease. In order to secure his appointment, he must be a man who is trained in the specialty. Since most clinics are woefully under-equipped, he must furnish needed equipment at his own expense and risk. Clinics generally require of their physicians that they see and make at least a pretense of examining and treating all the customers before the clinic closes. Closing hours are determined by the hours of the paid personnel. Hurried and careless work is generally forced upon the physician. Often the pressure of work taxes the endurance and mental poise of the physician, which is so requisite for careful, thoughtful work. The very nature of clinic organization forces neglect and deception of the patient. Under these circumstances, the physician learns little more than careless, hurried methods of work which become fixed habits. It is idle to expect anything but negligence and malpractice of the clinic physician. Quote-unquote closed hospital sacrifices. The most significant element in the cost of closed hospitals to the public is the sacrifice of human life. Though medical advances have improved the caliber of medical care and increased the expectancy of life, often patients fail to derive benefit from them in many closed hospitals. This results from the very faults that are inherent in the closed hospital systems. The medical boss is expected to lure or drag his patients into his hospital, especially if they are wealthy or if the case involves much publicity. Not infrequently, this is done at the expense of the patient's life. A notorious case of this character was that of a wealthy Long Island polo player who was thrown from his horse and suffered a fractured skull and intracranial hemorrhage. He was taken to a local hospital. If he had been a poor man, he would have been left there to rest and would have had an excellent chance to make an uneventful recovery. Instead, a prominent professor of brain surgery from a nearby medical center was called in. He hastened to rush off his prize to his medical center. As might be expected, the jouncing 65-mile ride to the center was too much for the patient. He died, a victim of the quote-unquote superior medical care which his wealth and prominence inflicted on him. Authorities agree that in some types of cases, hospitalization means an added risk of life to the patient. This is especially true in obstetrical cases, in which the risk of acquiring puerperal infections is intensified in hospitals. Few closed hospitals have medical staffs large enough to care adequately for all of their patients. Because of the desire of the dominating cliques to restrict and monopolize the use of their facilities, rather than dilute their monopoly by permitting competent outsiders to care for the patients in the hospital, the staffs turn them over to untrained, inexperienced, and often unsupervised interns. The opinion of these self-same hospitals of the competence of the interns whom they entrust with the lives of patients is made clear by the fact that after they have graduated, they are denied for many years the privilege of performing in the hospital the operations which they performed as interns on the ground of inexperience. To the public, the closed hospital cliques pretend that their object in excluding the outside physician is the protection of health and life of the patient. The falseness of this claim is obvious. When no members of the staff are available, the patients of the closed hospitals are forced to accept the services of inexperienced interns, even for dangerous operations, rather than permit the outside physician, no matter how experienced he may be, to render competent services. The lives of others have less value to merchants in medicine than their business monopolies. This endangering of life for commercial advantage is an almost universal custom in the closed hospitals of the country. A prominent surgeon, Dr. A.J. Rongi, FACS, has stated that over 50% of the cases on his service were operated by interns with or without adequate supervision. He stated that the inexpertness of the operations and the prolongation of the anesthesias spelled a grave risk to the health and life of the patients. This surgeon's accusation was amply confirmed in Commissioner Higgins' Kings County Hospital report, which has already been mentioned. The toll of death and disability due to the inexperience of the intern often is accentuated by the tremendous volume of work forced on the personnel. In many larger hospitals, interns are compelled to work from 12 to 18 hours a day, and in case of emergency, they may be compelled to work a day or more without sleep. Nurses are also compelled to work sometimes for comparable periods. Fatigue of hospital workers contributes to the toll of human lives in hospitals. Deaths in the ambulance service. Malpractice and error of diagnosis occur with especially high frequency in connection with ambulance services. Rarely do these cases attract any attention except when they form the basis of social service propaganda. They are so commonplace that the newspapers do not favor them as news. In the early years of the Depression, the social service forces conducted a publicity drive for the support of the ambulance services of the voluntary hospitals in New York City. As a result, some cases of negligence of ambulance surgeons were published in the press. They became news solely because of the activities of the social service publicity men. Quote, on December 8, 1931, the New York Journal reported that Clark Starbuck was treated at a hospital for a supposed laceration on the scalp and discharged. 1 hour later, he collapsed and died at the Mount Sinai Hospital from what was later discovered to be a fracture of the skull. On January 1, 1932, the New York Times reported that John Mulqueen died in the East 126th Street police station shortly after he had been refused as a patient by the Harlem Hospital ambulance surgeon. On January 18, 1932, the New York Times reported that Robert Francis was discharged from the Fordham Hospital with a diagnosis of mere lacerations after being struck down by a truck. Promptly after returning to his home, a summoned private physician diagnosed fractures of the skull, arm, and leg, unquote. The individuals described as the quote-unquote ambulance surgeons in these cases were, as usual, young, inexperienced, and unpaid interns working under high pressure for long hours, risking life and limb in the service. The failure of correct diagnosis was not their fault, but the fault of a system which forces inexperienced youngsters to do work which would often tax the skill of a veteran physician. Nevertheless, in all the publicized cases, the young interns were made the scapegoats of the system, and their reputations and records damaged. It was not until September 1933 that interns at Bellevue Hospital summoned up sufficient courage to rebel against being made the scapegoats of the ambulance system. They protested against the suspension and reprimand of two of their number for fatal errors in diagnosis on ambulance calls. One of the cases was Edward J. Sullivan, whose condition was diagnosed by the intern as alcoholic gastritis. At death, intestinal obstruction was found. The other case, Norman Frankel, involved two interns who, on three successive ambulance calls over a period of 24 hours, persisted in diagnosing what proved to be a ruptured appendix as a mere stomach ache. One can well understand the resentment of the interns on being made the scapegoat of the publicity attending these cases. In every large hospital with its mass production system, such cases are commonplace, even at the hands of experienced physicians on staff. Death in the hospital. The attitude of the hospital authorities to the death toll from negligence is one of supreme indifference if it involves no publicity. They receive no publicity and are accepted as part of the daily routine. I recall an experience which illustrates this attitude. Well, in my third year at medical school, I was asked by a friend, a young intern at Bellevue Hospital, to substitute for him during his leave of absence. Though my knowledge of medicine was as scant as that of any third-year medical student, I was entrusted with the care of a large ward of surgical patients. One night, I was called, after a long and hard day, to quiet a noisy, obstreperous, and delirious drunk who had been admitted with a fracture of the thigh. I ordered the nurse to administer a fairly large dose of peraldehyde. About 2 hours later, I was again awakened and told that the patient was once again disturbing the ward. I ordered another dose of peraldehyde. About 5 o'clock in the morning, I was summoned to the bedside of the patient, who was comatose and in collapse. The cumulative effect of the alcohol and the unwisely large doses of peraldehyde had been too much for him. I promptly administered oxygen and artificial respiration and continued it over a period of 4 hours. At the end of that time, the patient was resuscitated and I was exhausted. When I went down to breakfast, I was chagrined to find myself twitted and derided by superiors for having concerned myself about the possible death of an old drunkard, a death more or less in that mass of ailing humanity meant little, provided it did not show in the operative mortality score. Loss of life or impairment of health resulting from the high pressure of hospital and clinic work, accident, carelessness, and negligence is quite commonplace in institutional medicine. The hospital code of secrecy hides them, and rarely do they emerge into public notice. The attitude of hospital authorities toward death of this type is a pose of severity in the few chance cases which receive publicity. They stage a tremendous indignation which vents itself on intern, nurse, or other subordinate who is made the scapegoat, and a career is damaged or ruined. It is interesting to recall a few of the cases which have been given widespread publicity in the press of the nation because they served the purposes of the dominant cliques in medicine and social service. New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center deaths. 3 infants were put to death at the New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center in December 1932 by the injection of boric acid into their veins. An overworked nurse had injected the acid instead of salt solution ordered by the doctor. Dr. Eleanor Conover, director of the Hospital Information and Service Bureau, a social service publicity bureau whose function it is to propagandize hospitals and clinics, told the press that accidents and errors are rare in hospitals. She said, quote, "The nurse who has made a serious mistake is no more granted another chance than the captain who has lost his ship. The patient who submits to treatment in any reputable New York hospital has the assurance that none of the nurses who will attend her have been found guilty of negligence to date," unquote. More truthfully, Dr. Charles Norris, then chief medical examiner for New York City, informed the public, quote, "Something like this happens every 2 or 3 years," unquote. He referred to the matter coming to public attention, not to the rate of incidence of such accidents. Anyone can realize that persons who are overworked and tired are certain to make errors. There is an inevitable toll of mass production and fatigue in hospitals and clinics. This concludes this section of Your Life is Their Toy by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson from 1948.